would love to just get listeners up to speed on just a little bit of background about your entree into this world of dance and choreography. Was there a pivotal moment that led you to dancing as a career?
It was certainly not a career when it started. It started out as, like everything else, tasting the world in full mouthful. So everything was possible, and I knew that I had always wanted to be on stage, and I went to the university with the idea of going to Broadway and being an actor. And while there, one afternoon, my niece, who was my age and was going to school, said, "Don't go to track practice, but come to these African dance classes." And I went to the African dance classes, and I fell in love. And one thing led to another. Around that time, I met Arnie Zane, and we were interested in being artists with a capital A. So African dance wasn't enough. I began to study Humphrey Wideman and Tshaketi Ballet, and went off to Amsterdam, Holland, came back, was in school, and transferred to a dance program at SUNY Brockport, met a wonderful woman whose name was Lois Welk, who invited me to join a dance collective on the West Coast. We went out to the West Coast. We realized it wasn't the place that was quite serious enough for us. We came back, settled in the Binghamton area, Binghamton, New York, and started the American Dance Asylum with Lois and Jill Becker and Donna Joseph. And it was while there as part of that collective that I auditioned for the Clark Center Dance Festival at the Mall. And I was accepted, and I did a solo called Everybody Works to the music of Jesse Fuller. It got very good notices, and suddenly I was on the map, and I was being courted for management. Arnie Zane and I began making our duets. These duets, no one had seen them before. And this really added to a certain kind of push in terms of a career, if you will. And that's how it started. As a matter of fact, the pieces that we're going to be bringing to Salem, I believe there is a piece called Duet Times 2, which was made in 1982, when I was trying to branch out away from Arnie Zane in my duet. I was making my own version of it for myself and two other dancers. One, a dancer at the Merce Cunningham School, his name was Brian Arsenault, and the other was the great Rob Besserer, who some people call Peter Martin Modern, because he was the modern dance dancer to Peter Martin's at the New York City Ballet. So Rob Besserer and I were dancing the same material that Brian Arsenault and I, and this was called Duet Times 2. That's the first piece that we will be doing in our showing in Salem. The next piece on that program will be Valley Cottage, which ironically enough is where my home is now in Rockland County. But this was the last of a trilogy that Arnie Zane and I made, works that were exploring everything we had learned during the avant-garde period in the 70s. We were upping the production values. We were learning more about our structure, and we also had an international career.
Okay. I appreciate that. The duets that you began with Arnie Zane, I've spoken to a few dancers, and just they're speaking to how influential that early work has been in their lives. I'm wondering if you could describe for listeners, here's the magic of radio, some of the traits or characteristics that you all were hoping to get at early on in that collaboration that have really, withstood the test of time.
I think part of it was that it was incredibly intellectual. The spatial patterns were, start with one simple little circle, and then there's a line that extends from upstage, downstage, and there's an area over to the right that has benches. There's an area to the left, which is a circle of light. I mention this because this is the way we thought of it. We were drawing in space. So we were going through a kind of itinerary, a kind of steeplechase, if you will, of motifs that happened in particular areas of the stage that made it very brainy and very formal. The only difference was that Arnie Zane and I were not traditional dancers. Arnie was, as you know, 5'4", Italian-American. I'm a 6'1", African-American. Neither one of us had what you call ballet technique. And we employed everything that we had learned from contact improvisation, a very egalitarian, actually revolutionary form of partnering that through the use of leverage and counterbalance, you could have a very small person lifting a very large person. We used improvisation. We used a lot of freezes. And these things would actually repeat. So that 15 minutes worth of material through repetitions and accumulation could become a 45-minute ballet. That was the aesthetic. You were watching us be ourselves, but you were watching us go through this rigorous kind of puzzle of repetition and accumulation. Yes, I think that's probably a way to talk about what our values were. We were very extremely visual. Arne Zane was a photographer, as you know. And by the same token, it was something like no one had ever seen, because you could tell there was an intimacy between us, but we were very odd together. But there was a great camaraderie, and these duets were really tightly made with sandlot gymnastics, if you will, standing on shoulders, flipping, rolling, like Deborah Jowett, the writer at the New York Times, described us as big cats involved in some sort of a urban social ritual. I'm butchering the quote, but you get an idea of what it was like. And there was speaking. Because of my background as an actor and being the child of two African-American gifted storytellers, my mother and father, I was always doing abstract movement in my solo work or with Arne, some abstract movement, but it would be accompanied by some tale of my childhood or something I remember or something I read in a paper. And that was a hallmark of it. It was at once extremely formal and intellectual, but there was a lot of extreme confession going on and whispering and making up things, saying things improvisationally that made the performances very exciting and unlike anything you could see at that time.
Hmm. I was wondering what you're today here. Now, this is years later, how you see your role in this 21st century choreography in terms of the artist what kind of change can be excited through the work, either social or political?
Well, if I were to say what the DNA of our work, where the potency of those duets might have come from, and I'd say that there were two areas in particular. I think we were precursors to something we call now identity politics. We were never doing characters. We were always performing as these two disparate personalities that we were. Therefore, when we did improvisational talking on stage, it was coming from that very moment. This is something you probably see a lot if you've seen much avant-garde dance these days. We were also extremely interested in a kind of rigorous homemade movement that did not place a great premium on ballet technique, which we didn't have, but it was on something informed by karate, jujitsu, social dancing, tai chi. Those things informed our vocabulary. And you see that when you look at the work of many young choreographers today, it's quite eclectic. And it's more the ideas in the choreography than about the atrocity of the steps, if you will. I think those things came from the early duets of Bill T. Jones and Arne Zane to some degree.
Okay.
One of the first solos I ever made did an innocent thing, which was just to tell a story. But the story, because of how it was told, was a story that starts off talking about receiving a little white card in the mail, and then I list my Social Security number, when I was 12 years old. I then go back to the place I was born, which was in Bunnell, Florida, and I am confronted with my two aunts, my mother's sisters, Aunt Maddie and Aunt Purity Rogers, and they say something to me which was completely shocking. They said, Billy, you ain't going to do like your brother Irie did. He went up north and married a white girl, because if you marry a white girl, you can't come down here and visit us no more. That white card in the mail, the Social Security card, which is about a kind of anonymous organization socially, and then this kind of being suddenly defined as a black man with the limitations, those things fell on the ears of someone who was thinking they were completely free. So I was made, this dance that day, which incidentally was called Everybody Works, was done in New York, got a lot of attention, and it was very poetic, but it was also, people said it was political, and I didn't understand what was political about it. I was just reporting my experience. That, I think, also happened when Arne Zane and I began to perform internationally. Here we are, the short Jewish-Italian guy and this taller black guy dancing together, doing what we thought was an avant-garde form of partnering. Yes, with some words and free association, But when we went to Germany, they gave us the German Critics Award for a searing portrayal of the tension between whites and blacks in America. Aha! So no matter what we think we're doing, there is something about the eyes of the audience that is going to put us in a social political context. That has been a realization that was very important and remains important to me today, so much so that I try less to talk overtly about polemical or political ideas, knowing that they will be immediately contextualized as such. Uncle Tom's Cabin, yes. When Arnie Zane was in his hospital bed dying, he and I were thinking about our next work, and we were going probably every 2 years to the Next Wave Festival at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and we were wondering what we were going to do. We were hoping that he would get better, which he did not, but we were playing with the idea of an image, something which for us would be like grand opera, where we would employ the talents of a wonderful black soprano, Jessie Norman, and she would become Eliza from Uncle Tom's Cabin, and we would have her suspended on a styrofoam ice floe over the stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It was very like Robert Wilson. It was very much a pie-in-the-sky idea, but he died, and I was left with the title, Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, featuring 52 Handsome Nudes, and because at that time there was a Jesse Helms problem going on, and there was all this concern about nudity, we changed that title to The Promised Land. Now that he was no longer there, it suddenly became my piece. And I used Uncle Tom's Cabin as a way to, quote, move away from the anonymity or neutrality of the avant-garde to try to find what I call the black voice in my way. And that work then became a whole meditation on difference, something he and I had made quite apparent in our life together as a man, and also definitely in our company, which was always multiracial and multiethnic. But suddenly it became the topic, trying to understand the other, trying to understand what liberation truly meant, trying to rehear Martin Luther King. All of this was now Bill alone rather than Bill and Arnie. Following Uncle Tom's Cabin, as you know, ended with a stage full of every color of person, young, old, black, white, gay, straight, male, female, all naked and singing like children, bathed in a golden light. This was my idea of the promised land, or, quote, the utopia that the U.S. offered, that we do not have to be afraid of each other. Now, of course, it was ironic because there was such rancor, as we still see in our political system today, and this rancor had a cultural face with the likes of Mr. Helms and all decrying work that was somehow anti-Christian, anti-family values. Suddenly, what was a romp from the downtown art scene suddenly became a threat to the established order, and my work became a target for persons who were trying to understand what was wrong or what was right with our social discourse. Not of my doing, but it was what the time needed, and so I became a point of focus in that. Still Here, of course, came out of that last image of Uncle Tom's Cabin, a stage full of 52 people, all naked, standing together. But we have a change now that everybody on that stage is no longer allowed to share blood. They're no longer allowed to share body fluids because of the epidemic of AIDS at that time. I didn't set out to make a work that was going to be about AIDS. I set out to make a work that was going to be about the human mortality. Once again, looking for a inclusive statement built on difference. Many people got hung up in the fact that this work was supposed to make them feel bad about sick people. That was never the case. That was supposed to have been a work that was primarily a dance work. Literally, it had beautiful dancing in it, but it also had the testimonies and some shapes by people who had lived and were living with life-threatening illness. I'm sure you've read about all of this.
Yes.
But I think that's what you're getting at. So go back to the two young guys who innocently are dancing together in Germany, and suddenly they're being called black and white. And they had, through their hippie countercultural naivete, they thought that they were neutral, what they were doing. But the world did not see them as neutral. Fast forward another 10, 15 years, Arnie Zane has died. And now I am in the crossfire of a very heated
social-political discussion around what is the norm, what are the values of the era, and all these outside voices, these people who are shouting for their identity, were they in fact self-indulgent victims holding the good-hearted liberals with guilt, or were they in fact the clarion voices of the future? I think they were the clarion voices of the future. Because if you look at the work now, I am the artistic director of New York Live Arts, which is a reimagining, a merging of Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company, and the historic avant-garde theater space, Dance Theater Workshop. We merged, and now we're called New York Live Arts. It's not only my work anymore, it's about a whole generation, many of people are younger, who are starting their careers, or mid-career artists who are taking unpopular or underexposed approaches to performance, and we give them a voice, we give them a platform. And a lot of them feel as if their ideas definitely come from this time that Arnie and I were struggling with issues of who are we? How do we dance? Who do we dance with? Who is our audience? What is allowed on stage? All of those things. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Uncle Tom's Cabin. I mentioned Still Here. I had decided that I didn't have to be political. I just had to do the work I did, and it would be, I said that my politics are like my face. I cannot get away from my attitudes and my feelings, not to mention my race and so on. So I just thought I would make the most beautiful works I could. We made works completely to chamber music. We did all those things. Then I was asked to do a commission for the Ravinia Festival on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. I could do anything I wanted. So I tried my hand at making a big public spectacle, complete with the story of Honest Abe, but it would be also peppered with a kind of robust, physicalized, rolling, tumbling dancing that Arnie Zane and I used to do, but now performed by an entirely new group of people, some of them the age old enough to be my children, and with much more virtuosic technique than he and I had. There was also going to be a live band. There was. We had a Clarissa Cincino. He's a fantastic classically trained singer who is a jazz singer and an opera singer. The music is done by kind of East Village rock and roll kind of guys, Chris Lancaster. We were really trying to mix it up in terms of the different cultural reference points and in terms of historical and ethnic racial reference points, saying that this was, in fact, the legacy of Abraham Lincoln's vision for America.
I really enjoyed the PBS special covering A Good Man, the creative process and how the real-time nature of the work's evolution, how it morphed from what seemed like toward the end there, a day-to-day. One big one came after you're hearing the sound of a train. Would you tell me about your, at that point, are you feeling fear? Are you channeling anxiety? What's going through your mind when you suddenly are pivoting at that level, close to a deadline of that, you know, significance?
Well, yes, that's to the credit of the filmmakers. Now, you realize a documentary is only a portrait of subject, not necessarily the subject. But so, yeah, they made it very dramatic. It was dramatic. Yeah, there was concern about what, were we ready? I think when we even premiered it, we said we didn't think we were ready, but we were going to do our best, and we did. And when the work was premiered at Ravinio, we went on and continued working on it for easily another half year of touring, which is what is accepted. But, you know, that thing with the train was actually one of the glorious, mysterious parts of creation. You, just when you don't know what is missing, suddenly something comes into your subconscious or your conscious mind that was like standing there the whole time and slapped you in the face. That was a wonderful, I think it was a joyous, you could probably see, I was very happy when I heard it. Something, a connection was made. Hmm. I say this to young dancers, and I will say it in the lecture, is that a lot of art making is about responding. A lot of art making is about staying alert, open, listening. This is invaluable. You cannot, some artists do, I don't, sit down and write out everything that's going to happen and then go do it. I think you propose something And then there's something else that gets counterproposed. And then an accident happens that is better than anything you thought of. But are you really fleet enough? You know, I'm an old athlete, so I understand what it means to be back on your heels or forward on your toes. You've got to be forward on your toes so you can go in any direction. That's what was happening in the Good Man documentary, watching me deal with my emotions, but also and the personalities of the people around me and the circumstances of the engagement, but just trying to bring the thing in, bring it in whatever form it chooses to be in. That's all we can do. That's why I say it's a spiritual activity. It's not science. It's not politics. It's not mathematics. It's something more mysterious than that. It's called art making.
Oh, I had the privilege of speaking with Wayne Shorter 2 weeks ago, and he was coming up on his 80th birthday talking about that exploration and diving in and taking chances and being vulnerable and finding things within that I think speaks to that to some degree.
Well, that's why I think that artists should be trusted with the education of the young. That's why I think artists should be part of social planning, and we should be part of the discourse. I had said at the beginning of Mr. Obama's term, I was agreeing with Quincy Jones, who was sending out a request that there be a cabinet-level position for the arts. It has never, well, we've had so many problems with the economy and so on, but that didn't get off the ground. But I hope that someday someone will take that seriously. That we need a secretary of culture, as the French have, at the highest levels of government.
I couldn't agree with you more on that score. You're in every dance history book there is. Bill, you've received just about every major arts award and honor there is, which, you know, most folks would say is a great honor and privilege and a good thing. But I was wondering, personally, if you feel a weight that can sometimes come with that sort of recognition. I mean, or is there a downside? Mm-hmm. How do you juggle that?
Well, that's a very intelligent way of putting it. Well, it's a weight if you let it be. I do sometimes, I tell people, I say it's all smoke and mirrors. That's true to a point. When you're an irreplaceable treasure or whatever, what the devil does that mean? Irreplaceable treasure. Everything can be replaced. I think I've done some good work. I think I've proposed some interesting questions that other people have picked up and continue to answer. And maybe you can ask nothing more than that, particularly in a time-based art form like my own. I think that would be the best answer I could give is that right now I'm in a position where I'm working on a lot of fronts. I'm executive director of the New York Live Arts. I am still director and chief choreographer of Built These Homes and Zane Dance Company. And I direct Broadway musicals. But the question is, at any one time, particularly with the dancers, is what's worth doing? What is the next step? What is really worth doing? And with age, when you've done so much and you've been acknowledged and misunderstood, the heart becomes a little like leathery. You know, when you're young, it's like a balloon. It swells and shrinks and swells and shrinks. And as you get older, it becomes leathery. And if you let it, it will calcify. I am trying my darndest not to let that happen. And that's about the quality of the questions. That's about keeping the people around me youthful and upbeat. And that's about trying to be honest, like trying to talk to you right now and really say something that I'm not quite sure what I'm saying, but I'm trying to be sincere. I'm trying to be authentic. That's how I do it. And like I say, I wake up every day with questions about, will I make it that day? I do, and I expect to continue.
Thank you once again, Bill, for taking time out of your schedule to chat with me. And I know our listeners are going to enjoy hearing you speak and participating and getting a chance to see this wonderful residency here at Salem College.
Yeah, we're very, very excited. I look forward to the public discussion.